Today on Standing on the Shoulders of Giants, we have with us Joseph Joe Menn, who is a reporter with the Washington Post, has authored quite a few books that I've greatly enjoyed, and is a pretty strong fixture in the hacker community, which we'll definitely get into as we chat. Joe, care to expand a little bit on the background there?
Sure. So I've been a reporter, professional reporter in mainstream media for 35 years or so. I've been in San Francisco for the last 20 plus and have covered information security, hackerdom, cyber this, cyber that, pretty much from the beginning, since 99. I no longer write about breach of the day, unless it's just, enormous. I try to find deeper stories that explain how the world really works. And that's often still InfoSec. Sometimes it's other tech. I can write about other things I find interesting too. And the Washington Post, I only joined the Post about a year ago, and I was at Reuters most recently before that. And it's been a blast.
Awesome. That's great. You did mention sort of going deeper. Before we go into some of these stories, which I would love to get into, I have a bit of a background question, which is, again, like I'm pretty familiar with this community because I've also been in it since the late 80s or early 90s. But regardless, it's a pretty secretive and sort of insider club, the hacker and the information security domain. How would you explain you sort of gaining their trust and being able to author some of these just absolutely incredible books? I mean, we'll talk about CDC, we'll talk about some of those things, but you've really managed to garner a significant amount of trust in that community. How do you think that's occurred?
I think it's a combination of things. I mean, one is just not screwing up, not going for the cheesy sensationalist headline. Coverage of this stuff in the journalism community is actually not bad now, but when you started, when I started, it was mostly turkeys. People who were just showing up for DEF CON and then writing about people with purple hair, and then you don't see them again for a year. I think that's just taking the job seriously. I mean, I think a lot of hackers, especially the ones that I'm interested in, have a story or multiple stories that they want out there. They find systemic flaws or significant individual flaws and they want people to know about it. And it's hard to do that without the media. I mean, you can, but, so I think people who keep their word and do their homework and actually really try to understand the stuff and ask stupid questions, we'll get a break. And then it kind of builds. I mean, like, I wrote about woo-woo 20 years ago. And, the hacker community talks to each other. The people who are really good talk to each other. And, people knew people that I was writing about or people that I interviewed. And they'd check behind me, like, did he quote you right? Or, did he treat you decently? And it just, and I guess I've never been burned. I never burned anyone. So I think it's just going from there.
That makes sense. Also, yeah, shout out to the Woo crew. I think you were pretty good about not outing who all of us were back then, but then eventually I think one of us cracked and we kind of got outed in some of the TechCrunch stuff. I believe it was right around the WhatsApp acquisition with Yann and whatnot. Speaking of some of the hackers that want their stories out there, et cetera, and we mentioned this earlier. Let's dive a little bit into CDC. You effectively wrote a book on this. There's quite a bit of history there, not to mention one of the more famous CDC members I think that everyone knows now is Beto O'Rourke. So there's quite a bit of history there. And I'm a reasonably old school hacker, but they're even before my time. Like they've got some real old school chops to them.
Yeah. That was my third solo book and my most recent and the one I'm most proud of. It's an interesting story just about the CDC itself, which is the largest still functioning the oldest still functioning U.S. hacking group, and have just been in or around a lot of the real inflection points in InfoSec and hacktivism, which is a term that they came with. So they're interesting on their own, but I was really trying to use it as a vehicle to tell a broader story about how sort of like the it's an origin story of the good guy or good woman hack, the people who are sort of making their own rules and figuring out when to go against the grain and when not to, when to work with one piece or another of the establishment or a big company or found a big company, or when to, you know, throw your toys out of the pram and make a big stink. And, you know, I think that's very important. And I mean, I was envisioning multiple audiences for this book, but one of them certainly was sort of newcomers to the industry. You know, information security is a very big deal now, and there are lots of people coming into it that don't know the whole history, and they're probably not going to sit down and read 20 years worth of Usenet posts. So I was trying to like have a narrative thread that's entertaining and interesting to them, but will take them through like the big moral choices that people made so that they can, you know, figure out which they want to, you know, carry on and where they might want to make their own way.
Makes sense. Without revealing every single thing in the book, do you want to talk specifically about some of the CDC folks or sort of the background there?
Sure. I mean, the reason, you know, one of the reasons that CDC was great is that they evolved. They had like complete turnover, well, not complete turnover, but very different iterations. So in the earliest days, there were a few teenagers who were setting up bulletin boards in Texas, you know, back when, you know, you needed to steal a credit card or a long distance calling card or have access to a university phone or really rich parents in order to dial outside of your area code to connect with people like you to get some software, to get cracked games, a variety of reasons. They're like-minded folks. So that's how they started. And, you know, all the early members had their own bulletin boards and they developed kind of a network together. And Cult of the Dead Cow, the name they came up with, you know, it's a joke, but there was a slaughterhouse in Lubbock that some of them used to hang out at, and it was because it was creepy. And so they decided it was sinister enough. And we're talking about 14-year-old boys here, so it's not supposed to be all that scary. But that's how they started. And then, you know, they wrote funny text files. There was some clever marketing behind it. The founder of the group was a marketing major in Texas, and you know, things that are very simple in retrospect, like numbering all of the files, made other bulletin boards want to have like the complete collection of CDC files. So a lot of people, it sort of depends when you came online. If you came online like when you did back in the oldie days, you probably knew them first for their text files, which could be about anything or nothing. And they were silly, but, you know, they're cleverer than your average rant, I suppose. You know, because they were kind of cool and funny, they attracted people with actual legitimate hacking talent. So there's a lot of crossover from the folks in the Loft, the famous Boston group that included Mudge and Dildog, these huge figures in the history of InfoSec. And so they joined it, and that sort of gave them, technical credibility and chops. And then you also, so this is the late 90s now, and they become extremely well known for distributing Back Orifice and BO2K, which were two tools for breaking into anybody's Windows box, you know, which a lot of people hated. But on the other hand, actually forced Microsoft to start taking security more seriously. So it was a huge trade-off. And I found the interesting thing, one of the most interesting things about the group was those trade-offs and the some of the lively discussion internally about whether something was morally right or wrong, in addition to whether it would get enough press to expand the name of the cow and get famous for fame's sake. So there's that. And then there's the invention of hacktivism. You know, when they were sort of at their peak in the late 90s, you know, sort of like headlining DEF CON with thousands of people in the audience, you know, someone from the outside said, you know, okay, you're making all these points, which are great. Yeah, the monopoly software ecosystem sucks, and security is an afterthought, and so on and so forth. But what about, you know, what about other things? What are you doing to help people in China that have no way to surf the net uncensored? And this begat a wave of hacktivism that fed into the development of Tor and some other things, and has been revived, like, honestly, since the book came out. There's been the biggest wave I've ever seen of hacktivism.
I mean, no question. And for those listening, Tor is just sort of one of the, it's basically what they would call the encrypted dark web. It's where, like, Silk Road and all those other kind of underground sites flourished, although there's a bunch more stuff other than illegal things these days.
Lots of human rights stuff. I have people in Iran, people in Russia. You know, it's a tool for communicating without getting caught at it.
Yeah. And again, can be used for nefarious reasons, but realistically, like, there, it does serve a notably legitimate purpose, especially in today's world. No question there. You mentioned Mudge. Really good guy. But he did have some interesting stuff happen to him at Twitter. I think you covered more than a little bit of it. Is that right?
Yes. I had the big early stories on Mudge coming forward as a whistleblower at Twitter, which has been fascinating because a lot of people had never heard of him before that. Now more people. So just to give you some backstory on Mudge, Mudge was sort of the figurehead of the Loft back in the day. Brilliant, brilliant guy. One of the real pioneers in information security. And he was, you know, CDC referred to him as their hacker laureate. He was, you know, certainly one of, if not the most sophisticated, technical person in called the Dead Cow. And then he went on to do, like, to have this big career in and out of government, which is interesting because some of the people in the CDC hated the U.S. government, would never work for them.
Yeah.
And there are some that work for the U.S. government, and Mudge was among those. And he picked, I think, what in retrospect seems to be like a consensus balance for that period of hacking anyway, which is that he would help intelligence agencies figure out what was doable and what was bullshit, but he wouldn't, like, name names to the FBI. And there's a very big difference. Some of the earlier hackers that sort of went pro did do business with the FBI and were shunned for many years because of that. And Mudge didn't. He helped the NSA and other agencies. Anyway, so in the early 90s, he was the leader in transforming the Loft into At Stake. So not the first, but one of the first, their hacker boutique agencies that was trying to get rich in the .com bubble, and was going inside big companies to, you know, look at their systems from a hacker perspective and tell them, you know, what was more screwed up than other stuff, which was really, really valuable. And then, you know, At Stake sort of fizzled away and got eaten by Symantec. And he did a lot of work for DARPA. In fact, he became the head of cyber grant making for DARPA, who were the folks that brought us the internet in the first place. So extremely critical role. He worked on both offense stuff and defense stuff. And, you know, he became a little bit of a patron saint of the hacking community because he established these fast track grants. So that instead of like IBM or the University of Michigan or somebody getting, you know, $3 million to come up with the next, you know, cyber weapon or defense system, he would give like $50,000 or $100,000 to one or two guys or women that were coming up with something, you know, really specialist and unique. And so he realized that a lot of the best work is done by individuals, you know, sometimes misfits. And those that wanted to do business with the federal government didn't really have a way. And he sort of made that possible, which I think was a very big thing. And then he went on to other gigs at Google and at Stripe. And then he was brought in as chief security officer or head of security at Twitter, about a year before Elon Musk took over. And, you know, Twitter was a mess. Twitter's always been bad at security, famously so. And it was after yet another of these horrible things where some teenagers were like tweeting as Elon Musk and Joe Biden and whatever. They're like, okay, who's the best we can get? And it actually turned out that Jack Dorsey, one of the Twitter co-founders, said he'd gotten into tech because of Mudge and friends. So he brought in his old hero and said, okay, fix the security. And then Mudge actually had a terrible time trying to do that. He couldn't get buy-in. Jack was kind of missing in action. And so fast forward a little bit, and last year, Mudge went to Congress and the SEC under whistleblower protection rules and said, Twitter is an even bigger disaster than you think it is. There's national security risks involved. And they've been misleading shareholders, including Musk, during the purchase on just how bad it was. And so he had an extremely long and detailed whistleblower complaint, which I wrote about ad nauseum. And since then, there's actually been another whistleblower that's come forward that backed up a lot of what he said.
Right. Now, this leads into something interesting, because on the one hand, you reported on Mudge's activities and that he was coming forward on a whistleblower complaint. And it seems like not only was Twitter misleading shareholders, but it also misled Musk in the purchase, et cetera, which seems to lean pretty pro Musk. But then I'm sure you know what question is coming next. And that is, of course, you had a pretty famous exchange on the other hand with Elon, which in my, again, in just one humble person's point of view, should definitely put you in the Internet Hall of Fame, because he kind of tweeted, he tweeted right at you, like literally the full name and everything. Do you want to talk about your exchange on Twitter with Elon?
I'm guessing that you're referring to Musk's tweet in which existed in its entirety of Joseph Mann is a contemptible liar.
I believe that's the one.
Yeah, just what you want as a man of the press. The Twitter takeover was kind of the business story of last year. And, you know, I got into it with the Mudge stuff, but then, you know, I joined a number of colleagues at the Post, including the regular Twitter beat reporter and the regular Musk reporter in doing more about the saga, because it's still an incredible thing. I mean, the man is now in the Guinness Book of World Records as having lost the most money of any person in history. It totally has political ramifications, geopolitical ramifications. Every day it's kind of a circus thing, but some of the bits are more serious. So anyway, one of the themes that I pursued in multiple stories was the, kind of ad hoc nature of what was left of the security and policy stuff. He dismantled a lot of the trust and safety team. He fired the head of trust and safety and appointed somebody who'd only been at the company less than a year. He laid off a lot of trust and safety around the world, which is a pretty serious deal when people are using Twitter to organize violence against racial minorities. There's a lot of really bad stuff on Twitter, particularly driven by authoritarians. It was a big part of Bolsonaro's rise in Brazil. This is very serious stuff. And if you cut the staff and reinstate people who had been banned for inciting violence or lying constantly or being part of a nation state disinformation effort, it's going to have a serious impact on people. People are going to die because. So I was writing stories about that. And, as I think one paragraph or two paragraphs in one of my stories about the dismantling of the old trust and safety team, I wrote that at times Elon was personally banning people, and that in one of those instances was a guy named Chad Loader, who was actually an ex-security guy. He was one of the founders of Rapid7, but he had been banned on orders of Elon Musk, and Loader is a serious lefty activist these days, and is organizes doxes some alleged fascists, whatever. He's a known entity on that side, but had been fairly careful to follow the Twitter rules, and then he was summarily banned. I couldn't figure out why. And my sources inside Twitter said it was because Elon, you know, was on Elon's orders. And then this other, this right-wing activist named Andy Ngo tweeted that, you know, Joseph Mann left out the important stuff about how Loader incited violence here, there, and the other place. And then Elon responded with just, man, was a contemptible liar. What I liked about that was the coda. I mean, it was actually fairly annoying. I mean, you know, lots of right-wing people or Musk fans piled onto my mentions and accused me all kinds of horrible things. You know, it was unpleasant. But then maybe like a week later, I think it was Bloomberg reproduced like a screenshot of the actual or the actual banning order, which said, like, you know, per Elon Musk. And Elon didn't say anything about that. So, yeah, vindicated to the, you know, whoever was still paying attention.
That's fair. That's fair. I mean, I guess on the one hand, yeah, I mean, if you buy a company, you can kind of do what you want. But on the other hand, especially when you're tweeting out to everybody, like you're going to specifically like have fairness and there's going to be a total revamp of everything. I imagine it would be a bit hypocritical to say the least. Even still, having Elon call you out by name, you touched a nerve. I'm proud of you. I think that's great stuff. But going backwards for a half second, so we touched on hacktivism, but hacktivism has definitely shifted between, I would argue, the, like, let's just say 80s and 90s, and now it's pretty different. When we were doing this stuff when I was growing up and we were just goofing off, state actors didn't really exist. I mean, not really. The FBI guys, almost every person that I knew that had an FBI raid or whatever, none of them were technical. They were all like ex-accountants and whatnot. So clearly they've caught up on these various things on the law enforcement side, but I would say it's also notably changed the hacker side. What have you seen some differences in sort of the hacktivism from now versus the past?
Yeah, 100%. And I think this is, as an aside, just one of the most fascinating areas in technology. I mean, one of the things that drew me to cybersecurity in the first place, and instead of all the other bits of tech, is that it crosses jurisdictions. It's, you know, it's a tech story, but it's also frequently a business story, a criminal justice story, you know, a how society deals with the power of tech story. It's all these different things. And hacktivism is that sort of boiled down to its essence. And it can mean lots of things. The CDC defined it by at least three different ways that I know of. The one that stuck with me was, security work in service of human rights, which includes the right to free information, which is enshrined in some international treaties and has the force of law. So they got into it. The first thing they did, and I thought this was very shrewd on the part of the people pushing this, was against the Chinese government. Because as I said, while CDC had people who were pro-US or anti-US, nobody liked the Chinese government and the fact that it was censoring the internet with great firewall. And so they worked on an anonymous browser and technology like that. And, you know, there was another sort of big wave with Anonymous in the, when was that? Like the later OOs. And, you know, this was, you know, LulzSec was kind of a flag waver for a while. And they were like Bonnie and Clyde doing this performance art hacking, including like, you know, getting into like News of the World or one of the other Murdoch tabloids and printing a fake obituary for the man. You know, they did some entertaining stuff and some criminal stuff that, you know, which was harder to defend. But a lot of the anonymous stuff was denial of service attacks against, you know, various entities they didn't like. And this is controversial even within hacktivism, because it's suppressing speech. It means you can't go to a website. Those are not technically very sophisticated. I guess my biggest problem with the DDoS surge is that people in Anonymous told like 16, 17-year-old kids, download this tool and you can help with the DDoS and they won't be able to catch you. And in fact, there wasn't any protection for those kids, and some got sent to jail. And also, they were just kind of cover for the botnets, which were, you know, which some of the anonymous guys had, which were doing the real work. So that left kind of a bad taste in my mouth. But after Anonymous, you know, have come a number of other things, and sort of in parallel has been a rise in nation state stuff. And it is going to be increasingly hard to tease those two apart, you know, by design. I mean, one of the reasons that Anonymous didn't have the sort of, the myth building cachet of CDC is that the people didn't actually know each other. It really was anonymous, though there were hidden groups that coordinated behind the scenes. And therefore you couldn't really trust anybody, and they got infiltrated out the wazoo. I mean, any nation state, with any sort of hacker presence, you know, would be, you know, everybody would be fired if they were not involved in Anonymous one way or another. And Russia in particular got quite active in it. And that is just continued. I mean, there's been some really interesting stuff, some of which is in my book, the attacks on some of the great or the major spyware vendors, like Gamma Group, by an entity known as Phineas Fisher. We don't know who Phineas Fisher is. Phineas Fisher purports to be, an individual anarchist, which maybe, but he hasn't attacked anything that was in Russia's sphere. It's been, you know, Western spyware vendors, and the government of Turkey when Turkey was at odds with Russia and stuff like that. So that's one of the big mysteries. There are many mysteries here. But most recently, there's been all sorts of like hacktivism groups that have spontaneously showed up and been doxing Russian military contractors during the war in Ukraine. Maybe, or maybe that's just a beard for NATO or Ukraine, or at best like some joint venture. And Russia did the same. Like a lot of the hack and leak stuff that's become routine now. Is, you know, under the guise of hacktivism, but is really the GRU or some other unit of Russia. And I think this just goes on forever.
Right. And again, I want to follow that trail for a second. Do you think there's a lot of stuff going on in between that Russia-Ukraine thing? I mean, clearly that war is sort of raging on. And I think it's almost assuredly taken on a cyber front. In fact, I mean, a lot of people would argue it took on a cyber front before the actual invasion itself.
Well, that's a really interesting area. So I've written a lot about this for the Post. You know, Russia had been using Ukraine as like a proving ground for its cyber capabilities. You know, they even went before the war. I mean, the sides have been at odds for many years, you know, including, you know, Russia attempting to have its puppet be, you know, the president of the country. You know, mass protests and whatever. It's been going on. Guerrilla stuff has been going on for a long time. But Ukraine is certainly the biggest case where a country was able to, did turn off another country's lights, at least in part. And they did it twice, both during the Christmas holidays. You know, some bits of Ukraine were knocked offline by pretty impressive malware from Russia. And so naturally, everybody assumed that that would be a part of the big assault on Ukraine when it came physically. And then it really didn't. There were a bunch of haphazard wipers. There were some repurposed versions of the old, electric grid malware, but this time was detected. They tried stuff, but it wasn't, there were no screaming successes. And there wasn't anything like the real world consequences of the stuff they did over previous Christmas vacations. So there are a number of reasons why. One is that, you know, Ukraine was ready and they were anticipating it and they trained up. Another was that the Allies were all over their stuff. You know, US had a lot of people there. Other NATO folks were there helping them. You know, a lot of major cybersecurity companies and other tech companies were there helping. And part of it was, you know, why should we assume that the cyber would be planned any better than the other stuff? I mean, Russia completely bungled you know, the main invasion. So, and part of it was they were keeping it so secret that people didn't have a lot of notice. And the cyber guys like a lot of notice. So they can try and craft something new framework that's harder to detect. So there hasn't been a cyber apocalypse, but there has been a lot of the hack and leak stuff, the hacktivism dressed stuff. There'll be more of that. And some of that is about public opinion as much as, you know, doing damage and shutting things off. They're trying to show each side is trying to show that the other side is evil and losing. And there's a hacker aspect to that.
Sure. What do you think this means for warfare, or for that matter, warfare and humanity overall? What do you think that means? Is this going to be a continuous sort of fourth domain, or maybe fifth if you count space? But, you know, I don't know. Every time I hear Space Force, I just laugh. So I'll say fourth for now.
Yes. I mean, the simple answer is yes. Any major conflict is going to have cyber elements going forward. And, you know, that concludes stuff that is closer to electronic warfare, which is a traditional means of stuff. Russia, Ukraine was using these really great Turkish drones in the beginning of the war that were having a terrific impact hitting Russian lines as the Russians were attacking. And then they stopped. And it was unclear why they stopped. And it has been floated that it was because, Russia was able to hack the drone manufacturer in Turkey. And they did try, per Google, came out a little bit ago. But actually what happened is that it was electronic warfare. They captured one of the drones. They were able to figure out the frequencies that they were operating under, that kind of stuff. So is that cyber war? Not really. But there's other stuff like knocking out comms, knocking out cell towers, they knocked out the satellite communications network that the Ukrainians were military was depending on, which is one of the reasons why Musk became so important with SpaceX's version of SATCOMs. So that is closer to cyber war. But anyway, it'll be a small part or a big part. I think it's, in a way, it's sort of more interesting on the very low level or non-declared wars, where various countries will be hacking each other to pieces, leaking stuff, just for tactical advantage, knowing that they're short of the line where the other side is going to send up bombers.
Is there a present example of something like that going on?
I think there are a lot. I mean, one of the things I think about is Qatar versus UAE. Yeah. There's been a lot of stuff there that doesn't make the U.S. press a lot, but there's been a lot of hacking and attacks on. There were some planted stories on state media. Like one side would hack the other state media and plant something bogus. And this was during the time that there was like a blockade, and UAE was trying to organize people against Qatar. But there's a lot of hacking back and forth there. What else? There is still interference in U.S. elections, and the U.S. is still interfering in other people's elections, through disinformation campaigns, some of which are seeded with real hacks. So you can dump this dossier that has, some real material and some fake material. And then that will be amplified before the press can sort out what is what. So in the example, and I'm not saying that, the Biden Jr.'s laptop, was a Russian operation. I'm not saying that. But there was a lot of stuff that was not on his laptop originally that was in versions of the alleged laptop that was circulating. And it was super hard to figure out what was legit and what wasn't. And so that sort of stuff will continue to happen with overseas sponsorship as well as domestic activism.
Can we dive into the last thing you just talked about real quick? I didn't hear about any of that stuff. There were two different laptops or versions of things?
There are multiple software versions of the alleged laptop that were circulating to reporters and activists from the beginning. And while everybody, particularly the right, has yelled at Twitter for blocking links even to stories about the leaked laptop because it smelled to them like a Russian disinformation campaign, there was some, you know, and this, you know, was disbanded after, what, 24 hours. There were some versions of the laptop that were circulated that had stuff that was not on the laptop. And they were accompanied by explication that was not justified by what was on there. You know, allegations of lots and lots of crimes that there was no evidence of on the actual laptop. So at the Washington Post, colleagues did a deep dive with really good forensics folks and established that, you know, this set of emails is legit, that this set of emails was actually on the laptop. And there are other stuff that they can't tell whether it was or there wasn't. And there's some stuff that clearly was. It wasn't on the first versions, and then it was circulating later.
So this leads to sort of an existential question. I mean, you know, politics nonsense aside, the real question is, how can we tell what's real and what's crap these days? I mean, I maybe that's always been a problem. You know, I'll do a small little interlude here, but like when I was growing up, you know, you go with your mom or whoever to the grocery store, and every single one of us was always looked forward to the checkout because you would see that Elvis had landed on the moon, or because the National Enquirer is hilarious. Whether or not you like or dislike that, they were really funny. Like they had some really great stories. So this type of like nonsense
I'm going to argue with you there because, you know, as a budding journalist in my teens, I was outraged at the National Enquirer stuff. I am a supporter of the Weekly World News because, you know, most people are probably not going to believe Alien endorses Bill Clinton and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, okay, that's fair. You're way more qualified than I am. But what I meant is sort of those type of publications, they were just so funny. It was just like, yeah, I don't read this because I believe it. I literally read it because it's fairly entertaining. This is hilarious. And wow, that's an interesting alien that did endorse Bill Clinton. I wonder why he did that. What kind of intergalactic stuff is going on? So, but back to the main point there is just sort of, you know, isn't it extraordinarily difficult with, you know, there's extremely credible papers like New York Times and Washington Post in certain circles. And for that matter, you know, you can go to the other side with, you know, the LA Times saying that Trump was going to win. I think they were the only paper in the country that said that at the time. And then you've got other papers who have reported things that are, you know, reporters are just people. We're all fallible. Every one of us is fallible. But that doesn't mean that like you're actively trying to spread disinformation or any of that stuff. Is this a problem going forward? Like, is this a problem establishing credibility with people in the world?
So this is a huge problem. And now I'm going to pin it some of this on, you know, people, powerful people who have an interest in the truth not being understood. Because I think they get to skate. They've been able to skate on this one pretty much. But if you look around at the people who are saying it's all fake news, you can't trust the mainstream media, it's the people who have the most to hide. So Trump is paramount among those. But it's authoritarians around the world. Certainly in Russia, Putin, you know, the media in Russia is losing what little freedom it had. And it's because, you know, he's fighting a war that you're not even allowed to call a war. It's a, you know, it's a special military action or something.
I believe this country had the misfortune of calling something else not a war in the 60s and part of the 70s as well. And that didn't turn out so well either.
So I'm saying it's disastrous for this country that people do not give more credence to serious professional journalism outlets. There are plenty of problems with every mainstream publication, but they're not out to lie, and they're not out to fool people to serve a political agenda, with the exception of Fox News, which is, and that has been established recently in a court ruling in the Dominion libel case. which is remarkable, where you have people at all levels of the network saying, we're putting people on the air who are making stuff up. It's crazy. And then allowing them to go on air and not challenging them. That's pretty close to unprecedented among major media. For the most part, so I would say Fox News is a propaganda organ. It's a political organ. It's not a certainly not a typical media outlet. You know, I got issues with the Post. I got issues with the Times. I got issues with the Journal. But I believe, you know, if I pick up any story from any one of them, my bias is I'm going to figure at least 80% of it is true. And I don't think that's true for the majority of the public anymore. And that's a disaster because in an information, when you don't trust the established media, and let's remember that these people are trashing all institutions. Now it's the media, it's intelligence community, it's Congress, everybody's a turkey. You can only trust me. I'm the only one who can fix it. That is a bad road to go down. Because democracies depend on institutions. If you don't believe the mainstream press, then you're looking for other people that have answers. And some of those people are not who they purport to be. Some of those people are just grifters. Some of those people have just enormous access to grind. And unfortunately, social media rewards those who get engagement. And the way to get engagement is to be first. And to be, most alarmed and all that stuff with the exclamation points. It works. And Musk doesn't have a problem with that. Facebook doesn't seem to have much of a problem with that, and on and on. And now it's all going to get dramatically worse with artificial intelligence, which is actually large language models. And DALL-E and you can conjure a fake photo in seconds and spread it everywhere. And that's a nightmare. You know, when I started out in journalism, and since then, I do investigative style journalism. Sometimes I'm writing a daily story, but the stuff that I find most important is, deep stuff that takes me a long time and is really important. And, I'm trying to uncover these hidden but important things to tell people how society is actually working as opposed to how people think it works. And I didn't anticipate, having people say, well, it's in the Washington Post. If they tell me like it's going to be sunny today, I don't believe them because they're all liars. It is very, investigative journalism is hard enough, without having people, disagree that the sky is blue. And it's deeply, deeply unfortunate.
I hear that. I mean, yeah, your entire job depends on trust. Not only, of course, trust from sources, but also the trust of the people. And that it's like we're not out to bamboozle you. The whole idea here is that even if I do put a slight spin on things, that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is to bring you what's actually occurring. That's got to be a pain. It does. It's got to be irritating, to say the least.
I think the real problem is the complete collapse of public education in this country. The people aren't taught critical thinking. People aren't taught, ways to evaluate, the trustworthiness of a given piece of information. And they need to be taught that. It's not really the media's job to fix it. It's the government, it's people, it's whatever, it's various institutions. But we can't spend our time explaining that, but just take it from me. I can't, even if you think I'm like a liar and a communist in the pocket of the Chinese Communist Party, which I was accused of recently, I can't make up stuff in my stories or I lose my job. It doesn't work the way these people think it works. And it's super frustrating.
I hear you. Believe me, I absolutely hear you. Going back to what you were saying, though, we do have one of those people here in Austin, Texas. Honestly, I'd like to talk to him because he's hilarious. But he has said some really, really wrong things. The trouble is, this is Alex Jones, by the way, who I'm talking about.
I figured.
He's in Austin, Texas. The trouble is with Alex, well, okay, there's lots of trouble with Alex, but one of the biggest issues, again, with this credibility is Alex has been right about more than a few things. He's been, by the way, wrong in my opinion about more than that, but he's actually been right about a number of different things. And I think, again, this is one of the most difficult things, is really being able to suss out those things. And it's interesting you brought up education in the system and being able to do critical thinking. You're probably the third or fourth person, and I mean, I've only got 11 episodes of the podcast so far. You're like the third or fourth person to bring that up. And I literally couldn't agree more. It all starts with base level education, being able to do critical thinking and really be able to see the forest through the trees type of deal. But yeah, I hear you.
Just as an aside, that was another of my motivations for writing the Cult of the Dead Cow book. Because, I think regular people, hear the word hacker and think something negative, or they think criminal or something. But to me, like, the pure spirit of hackerdom is that critical thinking, because you're going at a system and trying to use it in ways that the designer did not intend. And so, I mean, I wrote this during, the previous presidency, at a time when it seemed that critical thinking was at an all-time low. And I was trying to hold up as heroes the people who and the philosophy behind original critical thinking.
Yeah, and I think I would argue that's probably the purest definition of hacking. One or two other folks have given me that same definition. I couldn't agree more, which is, again, utilizing
like applied a system, critical thinking.
Well, applied critical thinking and utilizing a system in a way that was not originally designed or intended to be used. It's extraordinarily interesting.
I will say to your Alex Jones point, skilled propagandists are never wrong all the time. They weave in truth. And I don't feel like talking about Alex Jones at all, but I'm certainly not going to talk about his motives, though he does seem to lead a very, very nice lifestyle. But skilled propagandists, in order to get you to believe the fake stuff, will throw in true stuff. And so that's something to bear in mind.
That's fair. That's totally fair. Not to keep going down this war path, because we've been talking about wars and various things of this nature, but a different type of war has been budding, and those are the encryption wars. We had these wars already. We literally fought and won these wars. They were the whole point of doing this. And for those, I think Joe can probably speak to this even better than I can, but like we fought this in the 80s and 90s with encryption and export controls and all this goofy stuff. And it seems like it's firing back up again. Joe, what's going on there?
I find this so depressing. So this war was won. The good guys won. You say, it turns out you can't ban math. And encryption is math. And the solutions that government was putting out, like Clipper chip, were proved garbage that could be hacked. Clipper chip was this thing that would decrypt anything that went over a phone, and MathPlays hacked it. And that was kind of like it was the last straw in the fight to mandate bad encryption in the United States. And incredibly, this has come back again. And, the bogeyman changes. It was terrorists for a while. That's why the San Bernardino iPhone was such a big deal, where the FBI tried to get a court to force Apple to crack it. Even though they knew there wasn't anything good on that phone, and there wasn't anything good on that phone, it was his work phone. If I'm a terrorist plotting stuff, I'm probably not going to use my work phone. So sometimes it's terrorists, sometimes it's child molesters, sometimes it's probably Russians or whatever, Chinese, whatever they think will sell. But they try to impose this stuff, and you expected in authoritarian regimes. And right now, in a majority of the Five Eyes, who are supposed to be the powerful democracies, you have at least some major parts of the government, like the law enforcement part, saying, encryption has gone too far, we're entering the dark ages, everybody's going dark, we need to, stop the crypto money laundering, child molesting, communist, anarchist, terrorist. And therefore, nobody should have strong encryption. And it's just such a terrible idea. And it's going to corrupt technology when they try to force it through, and the bad guys will use encryption anyway. And, you know, there's a million logical arguments against this. And sometimes people are just going to grandstand on this stuff, and it's depressing. They have not been able to pass anything in Congress. It does not seem like a priority of the Biden administration proper, which I'm happy to say. On the other hand, in the UK and Australia, there are really alarming laws that basically say that they can order companies to hack their own customers or help them hack customers. Signal has said it will pull out of the UK if one of the latest versions of this comes into force. But Signal, you know,
Signal CTO was actually on the podcast, so yeah, he's on the white hat side very much, but he's definitely, I don't want to call him a hacktivist because I don't think he does that, but he's definitely a security activist type of deal. He's not happy about any of that stuff.
Right. So, I mean, I think of most hacktivism as voluntarism. As Signal is, I guess, the next best thing. It's a nonprofit. You know, these people are not motivated by greed, and say that. So, of course, there's bad people using encryption, and so are banks, so that your stuff doesn't get ripped off. We're actually in a golden age of surveillance, which is getting worse. And I just think it's preposterous for the FBI to be saying, you know, like they're the only people I can think of who are saying the internet is too secure. It doesn't make any frickin' sense. You know, people are getting hacked all over the place, you know, including, you know, major elements of the U.S. government. And to say that we need less security, which is the same as saying less encryption, is indefensible.
I tend to agree. When did that start? Because basically, I mean, if we basically go backwards, right, this was all happening pretty extensively in like the 90s when they were trying to mandate this really crap encryption that we knew they had backdoors to sort of across the board. They basically lost like outright. Nothing. I don't remember anything really in the, I don't know what we called the 2000s, I guess the aughts, the zeros, whatever it is. But it started to rear its head. When did it really start to make a comeback? Was that under Obama or under Trump, or is that somewhat recent? You mentioned that it wasn't Biden going after those things, but there seems to be some elements of the government that may or may not change with the administrations.
Comey was certainly pushing it. Okay. And I think the director of national intelligence sort of passed, they did these waffly statements crafted by a million lawyers that says like security is good, without saying where they were on this thing. I think it does go back under Obama. I don't know about before that, but you know, the government is a big thing. And sometimes when they lose in the public, they do it in private. So there are a lot of deals for backdoors, some of which we get to expose and some of which we don't know about. And, that makes it much harder to figure out what's going on. Some of them, they just classify it and then they keep doing it. But at least there's not a law. I also think that we've entered this weird era of secret courts, which is not healthy because then you don't know what the case law is. And some of these secret courts, you only hear from one side, but you know, the most famous one is the FISA court, which, you know, approves intelligence warrants, which I guess I can see, but there are all these other things that happen in secret courts kind of as a result of that. And that can include demands for, you know, giant swaths of information from companies about people overseas or people overseas transiting US networks. It's still mysterious and infuriating. One of the biggest stories, or one of the stories I'm more proud of that I've done, is about RSA. The irony here is just palpable. So, you know, RSA, the company, you know, is founded by encryption pioneers who are terrific. And not too long after that, they set up RSA the conference, which is the largest security conference. It's coming up here in San Francisco in a couple of weeks. It was founded during the crypto wars, to band together the crypto folks to fight against the United States government that was trying to regulate them out of business. And so they were very definitely, the hacker good guys against the government being not only oppressive but stupid. And then, RSA, the company, changed hand multiple times. It was a piece of a bigger company that got sold to a bigger company, and its earnings are basically round off error. And
I believe they're two separate companies now. I think RSA Conference actually split from RSA.
I think that's true. Yeah. But at the time I was writing this, it was RSA, the company, ran sure. RSA, the conference. Mm-hmm. And the Snowden documents came out and they showed that the NSA had managed to corrupt an encryption standard, sneak it through what one of them referred to as an exercise in finesse, and get it into international standards, this stuff that was backdoored. So that and there are a lot of people that big companies that used the BSafe encryption tool. But the one that piqued my interest was RSA, because, the thing was crap on its face. It was incredibly slow and inefficient. And they had weird bits missing from its proof. And if RSA had been the old RSA, they wouldn't have taken this. But I set out to find out why the then current RSA had taken it. And it turns out they'd taken $10 million from the federal government to put it in. So, and they put it into this toolkit that lots of other people used. So it was such a sellout of the RSA ideals. So I wrote that story, and at least 10 speakers pulled out of the RSA conference after that story ran and did their own rival conference, which was cool.
I specifically remember all of that. Like, very, very particularly remember all that. That was some good. You changed security in a nutshell right there. That was a game changer, no question. Do you have a specific, do you have a specific opinion one way or the other as far as I'm trying to figure out a good way to phrase this. Do you have a specific opinion one way or the other? What's the most interesting sort of thing on the forefront of journalism at present? The reason I ask is I think that the background that's sort of rattling around in my head is there's a bunch of different stuff that seems to be very heavily covered on some sides of the media and very effectively ignored on other. And then there's vice versa stuff that some of those people are doing and some people are not doing. And I'm curious, I'll refine the question more along the lines of is there something we should be paying more attention to these days that we're not paying enough attention to? And then is there something that's all over the headlines that's just, who cares? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, people have gotten sophisticated. People who get covered by the media have gotten very sophisticated about how to use and abuse it. There was a great line from, I think it was the Reagan administration, where there was, something incredibly cheesy, a big giant check to a little girl, or, something like that. And the White House reporters were giving crap, the press secretary crap at, why are you doing this? And, expecting us to cover it. And the press secretary responded, "We don't tell you how to report the news, and you don't tell us how to stage it." A particular playing to TV, playing to Twitter, it elevates noise. And it is a pity when the serious press gets sucked into covering that noise. But it is hard not to, because that's what people are searching for. That's what people have heard about and want to know more about. And that's a very tricky balance. Particularly as, clicks become a deeper part of many business models. So I wish there was, I think the press and the public should pay less attention to stunt stunts. And if I was going to pick one thing that the press and public should pay more attention to, it's disinformation, because it is open season. The people who were doing it have gotten away with it. The new roles at Twitter are making it easier. And there are all these other alternative platforms you can use. And the good ones, the talented ones, bop between platforms. So there's a tweet that refers to a YouTube video that sends people to, you know, patriots.win or something. And it's impossible, even if those places were staffed decently, which they're not, to stop it or even slap warnings on it, which would probably be more appropriate. And so now we have every country in the universe working at this. And it is hard to report on, because it is aiming to go below, you know, below the surface and hide itself. And it is hard to justify as a reporter spending time to unravel something complicated when this thing just blew up over here and people are curious about it, but it's super important. It's, you know, it's one of those things that is going to be determining our lives, for years to come. In the journalism biz, one of my favorite, explaining aphorisms is that the mainstream press missed possibly the largest U.S. story of the second half of the last century, which was the migration of the rural black people in the South to the urban North, because nobody called a press conference to announce it. You got to be able to see the big picture and report out the big picture. Even if the clicks aren't there, they will show up for the real masterful telling of something.
Makes sense. You mentioned investigative journalism. The very first thing that pops to my mind, okay, forgive me because this is pop nonsense, so you'll probably laugh at it, but like, is All the King's Men. I love that movie. I thought it was great. I love Ward Werner Bernstein.
All the King's Men is a decent movie, but you're thinking of All the President's Men.
Sorry, All the President's Men. Yes. That's my Brit side coming out there. Okay, so All the President's Men, yes, which is a phenomenal movie. I loved Hoffman and
Redford
in that film. Is this, I'm being honest, was that something that was influential? And then, you know, that's more of a yes or no. But my real question behind it is, why go into journalism? Is there something, you know, in your, I don't know, growing up or whenever it was that really pushed you into doing this, that you wanted to be a champion for the people and report out what's going on in the world?
That's interesting. So in the first part, I'd say I'd already decided I wanted to be a journalist by the time I saw that movie. I knew the facts around it, the actual story and what happened. The Washington Post broke this story that was so important that eventually the president had to resign for the first time. That was a factor. That is the sort of journalism I like doing. I like I said, digging stuff up. And it's what I'm probably best known for. Me personally, there are a few factors, I think, beyond that. So I moved a lot as a kid. My parents were itinerant, untenured academics. And so I kept moving into new areas and having to find something in common to make with other people to make friends. And that is actually good training. It might not make for a terrific childhood, but it's good training for parachuting into some new industry or company or place and trying to find common ground and talking and trying to figure out what the story is. Another, honestly, is that my father could be quite a negative person and my mother was an extremely positive person. And from a very early age, I remember figuring out that I couldn't trust either one of them to interpret what was going on in the world. And so I had to figure it out myself. So, I mean, I basically don't trust anything. That's also good for being a journalist. And, you know, also I'm just like, you know, I was a bit of a class clown and disrespectful of the establishment. And I think that's also a good, a common characteristic among serious reporters. It's not, you know, you don't need it, but it doesn't hurt.
Okay. That's definitely good stuff. Is there, was there a seminal moment when you kind of knew you were there? Like I'm an actual serious journalist at this point.
Well, I'll tell you what, the coming of age bit was when I was a junior in high school and I was on an underground newspaper and the school board tried to stop us from distributing without their prior review. And we sicked the ACLU on them and, they threatened to sue and they backed down. And so we got to keep publishing it. And during that time, one of my colleagues cleverly, you know, called the local media and, they showed up to cover us. And so people from the local networks and the LA Times came and interviewed us. And I'm like staring at them and I'm, 15, 14? And I'm like, you know, thinking you're doing what I'm doing and you're getting paid for it. Like a really good idea. And so that was it. That was junior in high school. That's when I decided to be a journalist. In terms of when I thought I'd made it, it was actually quite tough coming up. I started as covering the night shift police in Gastonia, North Carolina. It was the town of Textile town of at the time about 50,000 people west of Charlotte. I was covering like murders and break-ins and stuff. And it took a long time to work my way up. The industry has been, that was when the times were good in journalism, in print journalism, and it's gotten worse, you know, steadily or dramatically alternating since then. And so I never actually felt secure in my skin, that I wasn't about to get fired, from whatever job I was at. Until I was at the Financial Times. So my career is like Charlotte Observer, Bloomberg, before most people had heard of that to learn business stuff, then the LA Times, and then the Financial Times, and then Reuters and the Post. And I guess when I was at the Financial Times and Reuters recruited me and told me that I could write anything I wanted as often as I wanted, I thought, well, okay, well, maybe I'm actually, you know, that was after the second book. That was when I was actually like, oh, okay, maybe I'm actually going to be able to make a living all the way through on this. That was a relief.
Was the first book the Napster one?
Yeah. I'd done a sort of a collective effort on the tobacco industry before.
Okay.
The first solo book was the Napster book, which is, you know, where Woo Woo made an appearance. The second one was about organized cybercrime, and particularly in Russia, and its alliance with the government there, which at the time was... That was called Fatal System Error.
Right.
That came out in 2010. And at the time it was, you know, that was the first journalism to say the Russian government is in cahoots with groups of criminal hackers. And like now your gardener knows that. Everybody knows that. That's how it works. But at the time it was something. And then the CDC one was the most recent.
Sure. Is there anything coming out that you're allowed to talk about?
Oh, good Lord, no. I find books completely absorbing and exhausting. And I'm in no rush. It takes a person year for me to do a book. And so I gotta like, not only care about it a lot right now, but know that I'll still be caring about it when I need to peddle the book, you know, 3 years from now. I don't get much joy out of doing something a little bit better than the other guy, writing an earnings story 20% better than the New York Times wrote an earnings story. I want to put out stuff that were it not for me, people wouldn't know about. And to have that is also deserves a book is rare. If I was working in a sardine factory, you know, I'd probably be working on a book right now. But my day job is fantastic. You know?
Yeah.
The Post is the paper that I wanted to work at when I was 16. And I'm working. So day job's pretty good.
Wow. I mean, seriously, wow. That's amazing. It took quite some time to get where you originally were. You wanted, no, seriously, but you did it though. Like you did it. That's a thing to be proud of. Proud versus not so proud. Do you have examples of something, of maybe stories that you've reported on, something that you're just absolutely that we haven't talked about that you're just really, really proud of that, as in like, this is something that's really, really exciting? And then is there something on the opposite end of that where they're like, nah, that one's not so great, or something of this nature?
I can certainly tell you about a story I learned painful lessons from.
Sure.
But other ones I'm proud of, I think maybe the story I'm most proud of is, you know, your readers might, you know, your viewers will probably not know this. I think you know this, that I was very sick 8 years ago. I was actually at DEF CON and I got a bacterial pneumonia, and that begat sepsis, which begat kidney failure, and went into the ER, you know, barely able to stand. And they put me in a coma for 6 weeks as they tried to save me, which they did. And then I missed like another couple months of work. So, all you know, it was, yeah, I was, they had, the first hospital wrote me off, and I'm very lucky to be here. And as I came to, one of the first things that I thought about was a story that that if I didn't make it, wasn't going to see the light of day. And so that even as I was learning to walk again, I started making some calls on the story, which I had just started on before. And it took me more than a year before I got confirmation, was able to publish it. But the story is maybe the one I'm proudest of, which is that the Chinese PLA had hijacked Hotmail accounts belonging to Uyghurs and dissidents and human rights lawyers and people in other countries around the world. And Microsoft had figured that out, and then opted, it had gone up to the board, and they opted not to warn the people that Microsoft, that China was hacking. I think they did it because they didn't want to piss off China. And China had control to a giant market. If you remember Jerry Yang, when he was CEO of Yahoo, was utterly shamed for turning over information about Yahoo users to the Chinese government.
Yeah, I remember.
But
that.
Yahoo was actually following the law. They had to do that. There is no law that says you can't warn people if they're being hacked. Microsoft was allowing these people to be at enormous risk, some cases of, you know, life imprisonment or worse. And, you know, I had it. I talked to the victims. I had all the documentation I needed, and I finally had got confirmation of what was very closely held. You know, maybe 30 people inside Microsoft knew this. And I called Microsoft and I gave them plenty of time. And I said, look, this is going to be, you know, a tough story, but I certainly want to be fair. I know it's complicated. You're juggling lots of things when you're in a country and you're not really calling the shots. Probably there was somebody that was arguing something like, if we warn these people, then we're going to get kicked out of the country, and then people will only have Chinese wares and it'll be worse. There'll be zero rail worse. There must have been lots of interesting discussion. I would love to have a full and fair representation in my story of that discussion. And Microsoft said, thank you for letting us know, giving us time. You know, can we have a week? I said, yes. And they kept asking for more and more time. And then finally they came out and they didn't answer any of my questions, not one of the stuff I'd wanted. Instead, they said, we'd like to announce a new policy. From now on, Microsoft is going to warn people when we figure out that they're victims of state-sponsored hacking. So I had two stories. Microsoft changes policy, and Microsoft did this thing which endangered people for years. And since that time, Microsoft has warned, I think last time I checked, it was upwards of 20,000 people that some government, probably their government, was out to get them. And that has saved lives. And so that is the story I'm most proud of.
So several things in there. One, I'm both proud of you and Microsoft for actually like not only bringing that to light, but them responding. Not, I mean, they probably should have answered the questions too, but like I'm glad that at least forced action. Two, Yeah, for those people who didn't know that, I did know about your illness quite a few years ago, and of course you're actually just coming off of something. So, Joe, really appreciate that you're here, and then you're still here, and that hopefully you'll be here for years and years to come. So, like, you know, stay strong and stay healthy, and that nature. On the other one was, did you have one that were, I don't know if there's necessarily one that you weren't like super proud of, but like. Maybe something, you know, maybe you can refine the question and make it your own.
Well, so a story that in a way I'm proud of, but I learned some very painful, important lessons from, was my second year in the business. So you got to cut me some slack. And I was in Gastonia, and I found out that some members of the police department there were beating up homeless people for the hell of it. You know, they'd wait to find one that was good and drunk. And then they'd call their buddies on the CB radio and they'd come over and they'd beat the crap out of the person, in some cases leading to hospitalization. And that was an important story. And a key part of that story was one of the victims, who I established, you know, was homeless and down on his luck, but not a liar. And he had, you know, he had physical evidence. He had clothes that were stained. They had dumped cooking oil on him, and he still had the clothes that were full of this gunk. And he agreed to be named on the record. And so, you know, I did other things to confirm the story, but he was a big part of it. You know, the impact of that story was that the police themselves investigated and found nothing to go on. And then the FBI investigated and nailed them, for civil rights violations. So I was proud of that story, but, that guy who spoke to me and who, you know, was brave and trusted me, wound up dead of a shotgun blast to his chest. And it was ruled a suicide. I don't know. You probably don't read a lot of coroner reports for fun, but I can tell you that there are not a lot of suicides by shotgun to the chest. And I'm not satisfied with that being the cause of death, but that's the cause of death that remains of record to this date. Since that time, I mean, you know, it's just, I mean, I believe that a source of mine was killed for talking to me. So since that time, I have, my top priority has been protecting my sources. I have never had a source outed since then. And I've had people that would have been killed or jailed for speaking to me. So, you know, I'm very sorry that that happened. But it has, if any good came out of it, is that it has driven me to be extremely protective of myself.
I don't blame you for that, and I'm sorry you and that gentleman had to go through that. That's terrible, but that's a tough one. Yeah, that's definitely an example of a tough story. I wanted to go back a little bit towards more of the hacking side of things, and so, or at least the technology side of things, and kind of talk through. What do you think is coming in terms of, like, I don't know if you've been covering some of the ChatGPT stuff, some of the AI stuff, et cetera. And I sort of have a two-pronged question on this one, which is, anybody who produces print for a living, ChatGPT's got to get you at least curious, if not worried. Now, I don't think it's going to be, I don't think there's any chance it replaces journalists. And I don't think it, honestly, I think people overestimate this thing, and I'm like, it's a really good tool at the best. And then on the other side, my question would be, you know, do you see issues with this in the journalism world?
So I think these large language models are going to be very important in all manner of, you know, all walks of life, really. And you know, many more so than journalism and hacking. But I think it will be important in both journalism and hacking. For journalism, it doesn't do news. It doesn't replace hard news. So it's more like a souped up search engine. Give me the answer to X. And, you know, frankly, newspapers have not been all that great at give me the answer to X. You know, they can tell you what happened yesterday or today. There are some folks out there that are doing their sort of in-house GPTs on their own bodies of work. I read today that Bloomberg is doing one that will only use Bloomberg as a resource to answer the question.
I saw that. That was interesting.
Yeah, I think others will do that. And I think that's a way that you can get some mileage out of it. I'm not really a business head. I know that some people in journalism and newspapers are nervous about ChatGPT. My gut is that it's not the end time. In hacking, I think it's very interesting because I think this is the first time that people who can't code will be able to code. Siri, make me an exploit. you can do that. And that means already the stuff has gotten more and more, democratic. It's been, hacking and technology have been open to more and more people. But this is like this could be like a 10x thing where, for scams, for, decent security work, for, cheap shot, skiddy security stuff. I think that's going to be very interesting. And like, I am concerned that like everything else in security, the advantage will be for the offense, because the internet escaped from the lab without authentication and defense built in. And because people, the capitalist system has people buying more and more stuff, which adds more and more lines of code, which adds more and more vulnerabilities. For all these reasons that people in defense are already painfully aware of, I think this is just going to be more of the same. Because sure, there will be some sort of AI to help you detect attacks, but I don't believe it'll be as good as the stuff on offense.
That's fair. As we're diving into this, are there, do you think this could replace copy editing or anything like that? I mean, I've seen, like, my mom uses it to rewrite her emails and whatnot. Like, is that something that could be a potential? Or I don't know.
I don't see that it gets perfect. For somebody writing a rough draft, it could be helpful, but you will need a serious reporter. The real journalism will need a serious reporter and a serious editor. I'm nowhere near where I would be thinking about trying to use it in any of my writing. It's conceivably in my reporting, but it hasn't necessitated itself. We're not going to lay off our copy editors because of ChatGPT.
I didn't imagine you were going to. Just seems like it would be an interesting tool for them at some point, et cetera. Maybe potentially fast forward things. You never know.
Yeah.
What's next? What's next on the horizon? Like, what are the stories we don't know about? Can you give us any small hints? Knowing that this podcast won't go up for a week or two or three.
So, I mean, the stuff I care the most about is longer form. I continue to be interested in the evolution of social networks and how they deal with disinformation, how they deal with nation state requests and demands and request nudges. I continue to be interested in backdoors after all this time and other methods of surveillance. And other than that, I guess, I guess the commercial spyware market, has come under heat. There's been new executive order, on that. NSO, appears to be losing altitude. But there are other NSOs that that are as good and not as famous, and they need to get exposed as well. So mm-hmm. those sorts of things.
Okay. These are honestly just things I've been curious about forever. How do you handle someone who doesn't want to talk? Or is like, obviously, if they just hang up or that's it, the conversation, I guess, is over. But like, do you ever have difficult interviewees or something of this nature, like where it's like pulling teeth to get them to chat? Are there any particular things you're able to do to speed them up or loosen their lips or whatever the case may be?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, nobody should regret talking to me. I don't want people to regret talking.
Of course.
And so I will try multiple ways to convey that. I mean, I guess it's different if you are the arch baddie, and I'm, you know, confronting you with a long list of your crimes and, you know, you ramble on too much. Shame on you if you do that. But other than that, you know, I'm actually trying to represent everyone fairly. You know, in general, I think people won't lose by talking to me. So, sometimes it's about conveying that. Sometimes it's about, you know, making clear that there are some things that I need to know, but I don't have to attribute to anyone, or that I can't even use without their permission. And I go over the definitions of off record and background, and everybody should do that because they vary from reporter to reporter. And I talk about one of my favorite Supreme Court cases, which is Cohen versus Cowles Media, or Cowles Newspapers, Inc. There was a reporter at either St. Paul or Minnesota that got an off-record or a deep background tip from a campaign manager that the other side was doing something nefarious. And he came back to his editors and said, hey, I got this good story. The other side is doing this. And the editors said, well, you have to out the campaign manager, the other side, for giving you this. And the reporter said, no, I gave him my word. And they printed the guy's name, and he got fired as campaign manager. And the guy sued for breach of contract, oral contract. And the newspaper said, hey, man, you know, freedom of press, you know, we can write whatever we want. And it went up to the Minnesota Supreme Court and then to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the guy who sued won because contract is a contract and promise is a promise. And so if I promise you that I'm not going to use your name in a story for this, you know, unless I get it from somebody else or whatever we agree on, and then I do it anyway, you get to sue me and take my house. And that's good. So sometimes explaining that to people helps. And then a lot of it is about motivation, you know, like, you know, what motive would this person have to talk? Do they have a moral compass that they feel something needs to be out? They just don't want to be, you know, caught as the person helping. Or, you know, is there some internal rivalry where they feel like they got, you know, ripped off or somebody else can promote them? You know, a lot of times I don't have to share the motive. And the motive doesn't have to be clean. But I think about why would somebody have a motive to talk to me? And I try to reach them on that level. And, you know, honestly, a lot of this, I see it as kind of like a joint venture with like the most important sources. I see it like a joint venture. Like, you know, there's some stuff that I want to print or find out. And there's some stuff that that you can talk about or willing to talk about. And let's just focus on the overlap. Let's find out what, you know, you don't mind me knowing or writing and what I would find valuable to write. And if there's stuff that, you know, you don't want me to write about, that's okay. We don't have to talk about that stuff.
Makes sense. Totally. If someone wanted to get into this line of work, what would they do? I mean, it's for a lot of people, this would be absolutely irresistible.
So it is, it's always been a difficult field to break into and get a good job at. And it's never been harder, really. So I would not recommend it for the majority of people, because, you know, people come in with big ambitions and then they wound up covering COPS in Gastonia, and they're still covering COPS in Gastonia until they're laid off. You know, it's the pay is terrible. The conditions are terrible. Most of the time, you're not doing really big stuff, especially in the beginning. And I guess, you know, more than that, it's hard to learn now. I mean, when the papers had monopolies, there are many things wrong with that system of the world, but they could afford to have editors take their time with stories and hire good editors and teach young reporters. And when you're a young reporter, that's what you need. You need good editors who will train you. And those people are much harder to find now. I mean, the good news is you don't really have to go to Gastonia to get started. You can go, you stay in your apartment and work for some blog or some news site that actually has readers. But the editors there are, it's hard to get time with the good editor because they're pushing stuff out for clicks. And one can go from those and get into a progressively better gig and eventually get to the Post, the Times, or whatever. But it is really hard. And it is harder now than it was then because it is harder to get real time with seasoned editors. If you want to do it anyway, you got to know how to write decent. You should take a writing course, multiple writing courses, and then, you need experience. So just get out there and start stringing or freelancing or whatever. And be willing to take a lot of crap assignments until you get. What I would recommend beyond that is try to make something your little patch of expertise. So even if it's something, and maybe especially if it's something that a lot of other people aren't interested in. I remember there's this Cub reporter named Brian Krebs who, you know, was interested in security even when the Washington Post wasn't very interested in security. And now I think he owns half of Ukraine or something. Yeah. So it worked out for him. So trust your instincts on that. I mean, I picked cybersecurity in part because I knew it was only going to get more important. And that turned out to be true. So pick something like that that you see coming, that is small now, that is going to get bigger and become, you know, one of the top reporters on that thing.
Makes sense. Okay, that's pretty good advice for folks. And then beyond that, you were mentioning the editors. What's time with a good editor look like? So you were saying it's really tough to get time with those really good editors, but I'm not sure people, again, if for people who are breaking in, what does that even look like? How do they know when they've got time with the good editor? Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. So, for any reporter, you know, sometimes the reporter comes up with the idea and sometimes the editor comes up with the idea. And sometimes it's some big shot high up in the newspaper that comes up with the idea and passes it through the editor to you. So there's that interaction where you talk about what the story would look like and what sort of sources you would need and how you would get it confirmed and, you know, what a good lead might be. And then, you know, there can be multiple iterations like, okay, well, this source said X, what should I ask the next person and so forth. And then, you know, most of it is after you turn the story in. You should have another conversation before you turn the story in, set expectations. And then you turn in the story and the editor says, you know, the editor, if it's a good editor and he cares about the story or she, there will be significant feedback, you know, down to word choice, lead, approach, everything, big and small. And then maybe ideas for follow-ups. At my advanced age, you know, most of my interactions with the editors are shorter, except for, you know, after you turn it in and then, you know, you're really doing it. And sometimes the editor will kick it back and say, can you rewrite, move this up and do something else? Cause I do something else. Cause they're busier than you are. And sometimes they'll just, you know, they'll show you what they're rewriting and you can argue any point, though you shouldn't do it ad nauseum. All that stuff is incredibly valuable. I remember, you know, I spent 60 hours a week on the college daily paper, because that's what I knew. That's what I was in college for, is to do journalism. And then I got internship. And I remember like my first internship, the city editor at the Pittsburgh Press spent like 15 minutes with me on a story that I turned in. And I remember thinking I've learned more in that 15 minutes than I did in like a year of college. You know, the guys who are good, are really good, and you need to open your mind and listen.
They can tell you where things sort of belong in the story, sort of, I'm guessing, the flow of the actual story itself. My guess is this isn't just like grammar and editing. This is pretty advanced stuff.
That too. I mean, many places don't have copy desks anymore, so the editor has to do all those things.
Right.
The post, we have both. Though, actually, sometimes you're copy edited after the story has already run. If it's an urgent thing.
Okay. Okay. Last question. If there was some sort of technology that you could will into existence, you don't have to code it, you don't have to sell it, none of that stuff. You could just snap your fingers and it's there. That has something to do with your field. What would that piece of technology be?
While I'm opposed to mass surveillance, it sure would be handy if I had something that could reach out and tap whoever I needed for a story within minutes. That would be handy. Bad for the world, that would be terrific for me.
Well, you didn't say that they're forced to answer, right? You just said you could potentially tap them.
That's true.
Okay, I mean, that's emails and phone numbers, right? Or are you? I'm guessing you're saying more of a directory of like, how do I grab this person?
Okay. What's Steve Ballmer's email?
I worked at Microsoft twice. I actually might be able to find that.
I have it too, but you get the idea. You know, there's not everybody has their email open to the world.
Certainly true. Certainly true.
More true with phone numbers.
That's very true. Okay. Well, Joe, this has been amazing. I literally can't thank you enough for coming on. I learned a lot. You want to give everybody your social, et cetera? How does everybody get in touch, follow you? I mean, Twitter, sure. Or Mastodon or whatever you want.
Sure, sure. So Mastodon is, I guess, my platform of choice. I'm at Joseph Men at, what is it? Just come back from vacation.
Well, you can tell them to visit your Twitter profile, which I think has your Mastodon address,
true.
Right?
That is true. I'm unimaginative on Twitter. I'm just at Joseph Men. M-E-N-N is the last name. My email is joseph.men@washpost.com. If you have a hot tip or come find me at RSA.
Awesome. That sounds amazing. Well, for those listening, we have been standing on the shoulders of giants. Thank you so much. Appreciate you, Joe.
Thanks a lot, dude.